I'm John Leo, and I'm talking with Mark Barrowline, a professor of English at Emory University, and author most recently of The Dumbest Generation, the only book of 2008 that insulted 82 million people. Mark, perhaps you'd better explain.
It's kind of a mean-spirited title, especially when you take the full subtitle, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. and people, you know, ask why be so provocative in this? And you always get the question, why did you write this book? And maybe it was I just walked into too many academic libraries and saw every computer terminal occupied by some cheery or intent sophomore pounding away an email at a machine gun pace, and I went up to the stacks and they were deserted. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was sitting on the quad between classes and watching the students hustle from one building to another, and we reached the point in which over 50% of them did have a cell phone to their ears to check in, to see what had happened in the previous hour when they had to turn that cell phone off. Right. So you just see things, you notice things about the young, and you know, it is a provocative title.
Well, the title may be provocative and may imply that it's a strident book, but it's a very thoughtful and sobering book. You've amassed all this information on how retarded, really, kids are in civic knowledge and knowledge in general. People will read the book and find your thesis supported, but what do you want to do about it now?
That's the big question. What do we do? I mean, we're not going to confiscate cell phones and Blackberries and make everyone get off that social networking site. No, the real challenge, and this is the challenge ahead for educators, for parents, for mentors, how do you take this extraordinary immersion that young people have in digital tools? Mm-hmm. How do you translate at least some portion of that immersion into knowledge and taste, citizenship-inducing activities? And we always hear people talk about, oh, you know, this Facebook page has been created and it was really important for the Obama campaign, or we have someone talking about, oh, there's this book reading group some kids have started through the internet. I mean, those are all wonderful things. But when you look at the full range of kids, the vast, vast majority of their activities are focused on what adolescents want to do, and that is to gossip and bully and photograph and display themselves, one another. And so what we need to recognize is that we have very strong social forces at work through these tools, and that parents and mentors simply need to be more vigilant about carving out some space in the day in which the kids are going to read the newspaper or they're going to read a book. And the parents have to do it too. You can't just say, go to your room and read a book. No, the parents have to create some time in the home to set up some walls in which they deal with adult matters, and they do it all together, an hour a day, and then you go back to your right. Fun and games.
One of the things I learned from your book is that there's an emerging rationale for not reading. I thought, I knew kids were not embarrassed not to read, but now they have an assault on the adult generation as being behind the times, as something old-fashioned and medieval to read.
And John, unfortunately, many of the leading figures in organizations that are supposed to be stewards of knowledge, guardians of thoughtfulness, have given way. Yesterday, I read a letter in USA Today written by the president of the American Library Association defending libraries for spending more and more money on games, video games, for kids to come in. And what he did was simply offer the statement that gaming with kids, the collaborative, the decision-making that they do in these games actually prepares them for the workplace, for adult life. And that this is actually an improvement that libraries should embrace. Now, the research on gaming is obviously highly uncertain right now. We don't know what the real impact of gaming is over the long term. But for the president of the American Library Association to defend gaming in libraries and say nothing about the value of books is a regrettable capitulation.
Well, that's just giving the customers what they want, I guess. Museums do it too. They have pop displays rather than meaningful ones.
And they're more interested in turnstile counts than in the quality of the experience once the kids get inside.
Mm-hmm. Let me throw something at you that's not in your book. I had a few courses under Marshall McLuhan at the University of Toronto, and he predicted that attention spans would grow shorter, that memory would go lax because a here and now oral generation is not going to behave like a literate, sequential, critical generation. It's just going to let things wash over them and not much care about the end game. Is that what you see too? Or
stand behind the 18-year-olds at a computer terminal in a library. Just watch how fast those web pages fly across the screen. Or listen to how quickly they type out those emails and blog posts and social networking text messages. It's an acceleration of communication, acceleration of language. And the faster it goes, McLuhan is precisely right, the more superficial it is, the more conventionalized, the more ritualized, the more collectivized things get. Conventions set in, the norms are so hardened, there isn't a lot of room for individual thought and deliberation in this kind of fast word processing world.
Let me ask you this. As you go around talking about the book, do your audiences contest the evidence that kids are not reading and don't care about history and so forth?
Sometimes they do. And part of it is simply a generational attitude. Let's face it, many of my colleagues in higher education, in the teaching world, they came of age in the 60s and 70s when youth culture was where it was at. And that's why I have that subtitle, Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. We all remember the slogan from the 60s, Don't Trust Anyone Over 30. These people have grown up now. They occupy positions of intellectual authority. But given their acculturation back in those heated decades, they're a little bit uncomfortable with that authority. They don't want to come off as being prescriptive to the kids. They want to sort of be relevant. They want to be hip. They show up in class with ponytails and earrings. And, you know, they simply have abdicated their job as being the stewards of knowledge, those who pass along tradition to the young. And so when a book like this comes out, it's very easy for them, well, this is just a curmudgeonly Luddite. You know, people have been doing this for thousands of years. Old people are always grumbling about the young. Well, one of my responses to that is old people do often complain about the young, rebuke them for their ignorance and their inexperience. That's part of our job. Mm-hmm. Why should a 15-year-old care about what happened 40 years ago on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, in the words of Martin Luther King? They're 15 years old. Reality is so immediate for them. They need a stern voice to come into their lives and say, history didn't begin on your 13th birthday. There is a bigger world out there than high school. There are greater triumphs than being popular among your friends. Well, adults are the only ones who are going to do that. They're not going to hear that from their peers. And so if you fail to rebuke the young for their youthfulness, well, you're not holding up your bargain in the sequence from one generation to the next.
What objections have been raised to your book that you had to take seriously?
I think that the idea that in the past kids were no more smarter than they are now, that I push too hard on the current state of ignorance. I think that's a fair objection, and that the comparisons don't quite hold. I'll accept that so far. But when we consider that in American culture today, young people have more libraries to go to than ever before, more museums, more performing arts spaces. There are more after-school programs. There are more colleges and universities with open admissions than ever before, and we have the internet. So there is more access to knowledge and art than certainly in any generation in human history. But we do not see any gain. We do not see any improvement in test scores. We actually see some decline in test scores in reading ability in the last 15 years. History, civics, foreign affairs, states of understanding are in terrible shape. And so I really say there is a new attitude, one thing that I push back on, and that is a certain shamelessness about not knowing the past, about not respecting historical truth and civic traditions. A certain we are different than you are among the young. Our generation is unique. We've grown up in a different time. And what you have to say to us is largely not relevant to our reality anymore. I'm not sure I have an argument in the book to go against that other than simply to hold up the value of historical knowledge and that no democracy remains free if its citizens are ignorant both of the principles on which that government is based and upon ignorant of what their leaders are doing within that government.
Let me switch the subject in the time we have left, Mark. You've written a lot for us, Minding the Campus and other outlets, on the inability of the academy to respect or even countenance conservative thought. How have you fared with that thesis on campus?
Well, I think it holds entirely. If you are a conservative on college campuses, you see that the curriculum, the general climate, the intellectual climate on campus is so heavily skewed toward liberal or left-wing or progressivist outlooks that when colleagues deny those realities, you know, the only thing one can do is laugh. Well, they deny it because they've spent so much time on college campuses talking only to one another, only facing ideas from the left, regarding those rare encounters with ideas on the right simply as a source of wrongheadedness or oddity to them, that it's really become kind of a social matter or a matter of etiquette and behavioral norms. That if a conservative comes in the room and says, well, I think affirmative action really has some problems when we're talking about college admissions, they don't sit there and argue over that point. They simply look upon you as somehow wrongheaded. You have broken a taboo. You are beyond the pale of reasonable discussion. That is the unhealthiness of college campuses today. That's the dangers of groupthink and complacency. When you only engage with the like-minded, you do get smug, and you become parochial. And this is, in fact, the opposite of the claims of academics to be so worldly and understanding the mechanisms of power and class and race and sexuality and so on. Frankly, the range of opinion that they face on all those issues is tiny, and it shows whenever you pull them off college campuses and have them talk to a wider group of people.
Right.
They don't know how.
Right. We've been talking with Mark Bauerlein, professor of English at Emory University and author of The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. Thank you for joining us, Mark.
Thank you.